the authority of Allah amongst us, we cannot see him, like obviously not Hujjah. Having him in the right. in the mean that okay. we cannot see him, we do not directly are related to yes. him, we cannot directly ask him yes. anything. His absence is a place to cry, but it's a divine. Mm-hmm. And something which becomes divine, it's very important. Why? Yes. Because this divine thing keeps the light of waiting for Imam yes. or that sense of waiting alive in you.
The light of hope.
The light of hope.
That's right.
If we say that these do not have any, like, advantages,
yes.
these sermons or just mere crying, it means that you're basically turning off the light or the hope
yes.
that they had through these sermons. Because there are many people, you know, everyone do not go after books.
Yes.
Everyone do not go after Quran or reading and all those okay. things. There are some simple people
yes.
who have their own life, who are just working. And then they have only this one sermon in order to get connected to Imam.
That's right.
So our duty is to connect all these people to Imam mm-hmm. rather than with the sermons or anything.
That's
so,
all right.
On its own, it has a big value.
And how many illiterate people we had yes. during the history who all of a sudden by night, because of their piety and taqwa, got reach high, we can say, ranks.
I can give you example of Ashab-e Kahf. For example, you yeah. know, the shepherd with yeah. the Ashab-e Kahf.
Yeah.
He's an illiterate.
Yeah.
He joined them. Why? Okay. Because he also believed in a God who he could not see, who is beyond the Pharaoh yeah. of that time. But obviously, he had those thoughts, and he joined them.
Yes.
So there are different levels of people yes. who will become, obviously, the part of the companions, the true companions of Imam. Okay. But obviously, we need to see at which place we fall.
Yes.
And
so in this way, we have to be conscious about our behaviors towards the people around us. Because sometimes we act and behave some people around us in a harsh manner.
Yeah.
Maybe we consider him as a true follower of the Imam. We do not know he is a true follower of the Imam. Okay, we are behaving him in a harsh way.
What? I need to collect between the ideas which were posed here.
Okay.
What the respected Sayyid said and okay. what I said as for the importance of the crying. I think crying or shedding tears is, as I said, it's not enough. And the respected said to some extent it can be actually important. Yeah. There is no there is no doubt that it is actually important. But when it comes with enlightenment, mm-hmm. look, when the leader of the Islamic Ummah says that shedding tears for the arrival of Imam is not enough, he means that actually he wants to refer to those who actually suffice to that extent of shedding tears for Imam, and they do not care for anything else. So actually, Imam of the Ummah, that is the leader of the Islamic Ummah, wanted to distinguish between those who shed tears for the arrival of Imam, and at the same time they are active and they are in a movement, because expectation, intidhar, by itself is not something stagnant. It is something that actually is moving ahead.
Right.
So Imam of the Ummah wanted to let us know that shedding tears by itself is important and sacred, but it's not enough. So when this shedding tears, actually, because there are two sometimes concepts in some communities, they say, okay, we just need to stay somewhere and shed tears for arrival of Imam
yeah.
and just supplicate. This is the only duty that we have at the
yes.
time of
occultation.
That's
right.
Occultation of Imam. Leader wants to tell us, no, this is not enough. Here you have to work. You have to actually prepare the way for his arrival.
Right.
You have to do the things, the works that he will do in future. Like
That's
what?
Right.
Like to be sympathetic towards the human beings in
okay.
case they have problem or they are in problem. They have been entrapped by any problem, difficulty.
Okay.
So it's your duty to do something to relieve them. So this is what he actually refers to.
Thank you much, Brother Ali Alavian.
Thanks to you, brother. Thanks for inviting me.
And Sayyid Mohsen Nawi.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
can I find you, my master? In the unknown. When you're not here, I feel so lost, I feel alone. Calling your name with a broken heart, come to my so many nights, so many days for you, my friend. I know, my master, that I have many times strayed. I forgot you, I have hurt you. But my heart's pouring with your love, can you not see how much I need you with me? Come and save me. Every day feels darker than the day that has passed. Each day wears down my patience, but I am steadfast. Just to see one glimpse of you is all I have asked. How much more longer do I wait? How long will this last?
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions. And questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear listeners, wherever you are, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer the questions with regard to theology or whatever goes towards religion and the beliefs of people, specifically the followers of the School of Ahlul Bayt, in order to discuss these issues with scholars from seminary schools. We have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to this session. I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him.
Wa alaikum salam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. The question of the day that we want to discuss it today in this very show is concerning the cutting of the hands for a thief as one of the Islamic rulings. It has been asked that cutting of the hands is a sort of barbarity and savagery, and they want actually to indirectly defame and distort the picture of Islam, the picture which is intermingled with peace and blessings, and with and it is known the religion of peace. The person, the questioner, wants to say that no, well, there is no peace in the religion that you are following because you cut off the hands of the thieves while they actually commit a mistake. So is it really a justice that you are cutting off his hand? He made a mistake and he does not deserve to do so, and he does not deserve to be so. So and in other religions, as the questioner says, as the questioner wants to say, in other religions such a thing does not exist. Why do you guys actually propagate Islam? And you, in fact, you are propagating savagery and barbarity. And there is nothing to do with justice that you say that this is the exact justice that you are implementing. Shaykhun, this is something that actually is directed to Islamic rulings and regulations. What is the answer to such a question? We know that the Islamic rulings have been revealed and have come to us in order to bring order in the society. In case we refrain from doing Islamic rules and regulations, we shall face a chaos in the societies. So how can we scientifically answer this respected question?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, when we say cutting the hands, is not, we do not mean the whole hand, it's only four fingers. Talking about all the hudud.
And before you enter, can you tell us when exactly we cut off the hands of a thief?
This is one of the points that I need to mention later in the program.
Okay,
I need some introduction to be mentioned. When it comes to the hudud, we know that the punishment for the crimes are of two types. Some of them are hudud, which means that the fixed punishment and penalties. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, the Quran or the narrations tell us that this is the punishment of adultery, for example. This is the punishment of stealing and so on and so forth.
True.
For some of the sins, there is no fixed punishment. It is up to the decision of the Muslim judge to decide about. This is called ta'zir. So when we are talking about hudud or the fixed punishment in the religion of Islam, now we live in the era of major occultation.
True.
First of all, we need to clarify the point that there is a discussion among the Shia scholars that are we allowed to implement the Islamic rulings regarding hudud at the time of major occultation or not? Some of the scholars, when we go and study the books of the Shia scholars regarding this issue, some of the Shia jurists, they say that we have no idea. We are not sure whether we need to implement the Islamic hudud in the time of major occultation or not. Before that, let me refer to one point. When we are talking about these punishments, we are talking about an Islamic government. So Muslims living in the West, for example, in a non-Muslim country, they have no right to, capture a thief, for example, and then to implement this Islamic punishment, not at all. When we are talking about Islamic punishments, we are talking about an Islamic government, and then under that Islamic government, all the people agree that they are living in a country where Islamic laws are going to be implemented. So only in that environment we are talking about implementing the hudud and the fixed penalties and punishments. Mm-hmm. So non-Muslims should not think that Muslims will implement these punishments in every part of the world. No, in every country they need to act upon the laws and regulations of that specific country. So no Muslim jurist gives you a permission, as far as the Shia jurists are concerned, no Shia jurist gives you the permission to implement the hudud when you live in a non-Muslim country. It should be understood only within the territory of Islamic government. Having said that, again, still we have a discussion among the Shia scholars. Do, even in a Muslim country, do we have the right to implement the hudud at a time of major occultation? Some of the jurists in the past, they say that we have no idea, because it's a serious issue. Sometimes, the punishment is the capital punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So a great scholar like Allama Helli, he says that Sheikh Mufid and Sheikh Atusi, they believe that we can implement the hudud at the time of the major occultation. But my idea is that I have no idea. I mean, stop giving a fatwa regarding this issue. So this is the first viewpoint. The second viewpoint is that some Shia scholars believe that at the time of the major occultation, we have no right to implement the hudud. Like, for example, we have the late Khansari. He says that many scholars in the past believe that we are not allowed to implement hudud at the time of major occultation. And I also have the same viewpoint. The third group of the scholars, which includes some of the scholars in the past and the majority of contemporary Shia scholars, they believe that no, there is no difference between the time of the presence of an imam or the occultation of an imam. So the philosophy is there. Why we have Islamic punishments for some crimes? The same philosophies are applicable for the time of the major occultation. So we need to act upon the Islamic laws and hudud even during the major occultation. This is the viewpoint of the majority of the Shia scholars in our time. So this is the first point that I thought that it might be helpful for some people to know that at least there are some people who disagree with this idea.
Yeah.
Now, answering your question, to implement the punishment for stealing and theft, there are many conditions. First of all, maturity. So if a kid does that, this punishment will not be implemented. Aql or sanity. So if an insane person does that, he will not be punished. I mean, this punishment will not be implemented. Free will and not being in emergency conditions is very important. Sometimes we have some emergency conditions, or for example, fatigue, for example, and people are starving to death. If a person steals under such conditions, this punishment will not be implemented. And then there are many conditions about the place from which the good is stolen. For example, there must be a kind of lock, and the lock should be broken. And it should be, I mean, in a hidden place, and so on and so forth. So there are many conditions for implementing these Islamic rulings. And especially, as I mentioned, if it's a matter of a non-mature person, or if it is a matter of emergency cases, or at the time of famine, for example, when people are starving to death, then this Islamic law will not be implemented. Now, I will come to the philosophy of this Islamic ruling, but before that, I think another point should be taken into consideration as well. When we refer to the history of Islam, I mean, at the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, and at the time of the Imams of the Ahl Bayt, we do not see many reports about cutting the fingers of a thief. It's very strange. And I think we need to have a kind of analysis for that. I think we can come to at least two conclusions. The first conclusion is that although the Islamic punishments for such crimes like theft and adultery and homosexuality might seem serious, but in practice, to prove them is not something, lightly or something light and easy to prove. For many of these crimes, there are many conditions for them to be proved for the for the Muslim jurist. So it's not an easy task for a Muslim jurist to come to the conclusion that, for example, such a person has committed adultery or sodomy or theft and so on and so forth. There are many conditions in this regard. So the punishments are serious. But to prove them is difficult. The result is that
Proving them might take once in a blue moon.
Exactly. But, the result of having serious punishment and difficult ways of proving is that Muslim, they have a very, they are very cautious about acting and committing these crimes because the punishments are serious. That is why I want to come to the second conclusion, why we do not hear about many instances of these crimes and these hudud implemented at the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. We can say that having these serious punishments for these sins is acting as a kind of obstacle and hindrance for the people to commit the sins. So when all the Muslims know that there is a serious punishment for adultery, there is a serious punishment for, rape, for, homosexuality, for theft, so they take it seriously as well. They are not ready to do that, publicly or on a daily basis. So this serious punishment, it's one of the good benefits of the serious punishment is that it really acts as a kind of hindrance for the people. And that is why we do not have so many examples of these crimes being done at the time of the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt.
So it brings a sort of prevention from doing such actions,
exactly,
as you said. And proving them is really difficult, and so we don't have many cases. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations, and you respect listeners for staying tuned and listening to us. We have understood that these preventive rulings that Islam actually introduces and brings about for bringing safety and order in society, it's true that they are a little bit harsh for somebody if he hears or sees them, but proving them is not that easy, as the respected speaker of the show said. To prove that a person had stolen something or not, and into what level, actually is something which rarely happens, and it cannot be seen very easily in these societies. So, all in all, this was the discussion that we had on the harshness of some of the punishments in Islamic worldview, and we shall get back to you with another question to be discussed in our Q&A in our upcoming session. Wassalamu alaikum. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
Aperture. Welcome back, everyone. We witness how, cloaked in the shadows from the light of public scrutiny, the Bilderberg Group began to form their own self-serving agendas and wielded their immense power and resources to redesign the world in their vision. Yet, today, this old institution faces a new climate thanks to a new wave of savvy investigative journalists who attempt to peel away the secret history and ongoing influence of this organization. Don't go away. Here's the next part.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been deeply involved in the Bilderberg Group, a
attending dozens of their meetings over the years and acting on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Kissinger faces allegations of war crimes for his involvement in the secret bombing campaign that took place in Cambodia during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. It is alleged that Kissinger willfully engaged in the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in various areas of Cambodia, which led to the destabilization of the country into a civil war, resulting in the rise of the infamous Khmer Rouge. Kissinger is also wanted in several countries for his involvement in supporting the Pinochet regime and the CIA-backed coup that took place in Chile on September 11, 1973. Pinochet, who is now facing a war crimes tribunal, murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende and started a military junta, which resulted in the kidnapping, forced displacement, and torture of thousands of men, women, and children in Chile. Henry Kissinger actively supported these actions that were taking place at that time, which constituted crimes against humanity. Kissinger was also involved in a controversial study in 1974 called National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which the basic thesis called for an active campaign for the depopulation of several less developed countries to stem the risk for civil unrest.
Are you still giving out orders like Memorandum 200, where you said depopulation should be hell? Sir, just a question. I'm not going to go to hell, because Memorandum 200, sir? Memorandum 200. Just ask them a question about Memorandum 200 that he wrote in April 24, 1974. It's an honest question. Okay. Kissinger, Memorandum 200. Depopulation.
We're on topic now. We came here. We give you the access. You want to burn bridges? You can do that.
I don't want to burn any bridges. I didn't. I wasn't disrespectful. I wasn't accusatory. It was a serious question.
We're on topic.
Okay, I understand that. So, what about the depopulation? I mean, Memorandum 200. Why are you afraid to talk about your depopulation plan?
Why don't you get lost?
Why should I get lost? It's serious.
Sick person.
Sick person. How am I sick? You're the one committing.
I hope it's the beginning of a whole new epoch of greater and greater coverage. At the same time, we're in danger because of their designs on the internet. This could also be the high watermark. It really depends on who stands their ground and what the fight will be. Because, of course, we've just broke last week, people from the European Commission, the Dutch woman, Neelie Kroes, wants a mandatory internet ID for Europe. Cybercom was launched only 2 years ago. We saw the Stuxnet virus, admittedly engineered from the U.S. and Israeli and other related allies to use against Iran and so forth. On that pretext, they want to take greater and greater control of the web. The United Nations also trying to have a reach over the web.
The Bilderberg Group include many prominent members of the internet and computing world, including co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, founder of PayPal and chief Facebook investor, Peter Thiel, executive chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, Vice President, European Commission, Commissioner for Digital Agenda, Neelie Kroes, Chief Research and Strategy Officer, Microsoft Corporation, Craig J. Mundy, and many others.
More and more, we're seeing the Iron Curtain of media censorship on Bilderberg and the shadow government, shadow elite, pulled back. So we're seeing Bilderberg basically try to pass the baton off to younger people right now, a bunch of tech folks, Google, Facebook, and others, hoping that the police state tech grid can protect their criminal activity. They're trying to push a global bank as the solution to all our problems that they created. They're openly trying to push more police state systems. They want to end internet freedom. They want to bring in internet IDs.
The mainstream media is no longer mainstream. The alternative is taking over, and they're trying their damnedest to either restrict or shut down the free internet as we know it right now.
The increase of internet-based media has been closely correlated with the decrease of traditional forms of media, such as newspapers and television, which have been monopolized by members of the Bilderberg Group. In their efforts to maintain the control of information globally, influential figures of the media have been routinely invited to participate in the conferences over the years. Peter Mansbridge of CBC's The National attended the meeting in 2010 and has maintained their strict rules for secrecy ever since. Fellow Canadian Heather Reisman is the CEO of Indigo Books, the largest book supplier in Canada, and she is a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. In 2005, Reisman founded the Hesseg Foundation, which provides grants to former lone soldiers in the Israeli Army to pursue post-secondary education. A lone soldier is an individual who is not from Israel, but chooses to fight in the Israeli military. Other media moguls and organizations that have attended the Bilderberg meetings over the years have included Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, Andrew Knight of News Corporation and The Economist, Ted Turner of Time Warner and CNN, Charlie Rose, Donald Graham of The Washington Post, and Canadian media baron and former Bilderberg Steering Committee member Conrad Black of Hollinger International and The Telegraph newspaper. While all of these powerful media organizations have been present at Bilderberg meetings over the years, there has remained a media blackout all across the board regarding coverage of this group.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering what your opinions were. You talk a little bit about it in the book, of the influence of the Bilderberg group on the mainstream media, or on just the influence.
The individuals are influential, but their influence isn't magnified by Bilderberg. I went for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a talking shop, and they're almost always wrong, by the way. They didn't see the end of the Cold War coming. They didn't see the economic crisis coming. They're very interesting meetings. They're very interesting people, but they're not coherent. They aren't a group that meets other than for 3 days a year, and the composition of them changes all the time, except for about 30 of us who are on the steering committee.
And how come?
Don't buy into these conspiracy theories. It's rubbish. All they do is talk to each other. I was on that conference circuit for 20 years, the Trilateral Commission, and I went to all of them. And look, it was fine while it lasted, but I'm getting too old for that. I'm getting tired. But,
okay.
You know.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Right.
But there's no conspiracy in any of them.
No.
But, no, there's a bunch of people.
How come you never hear about it in the media? Like, I only read about it in your book.
They don't allow the media.
No.
But in order to encourage people to talk frankly, which you do, you get good, frank sessions. But there's no meeting of the minds, particularly.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Fellow Hollinger International Board of Directors member Marie-José Kravis has made significant inroads since being invited to Bilderberg by Conrad Black in 1989. Marie-José is the wife of Bilderberg member Henry Kravis and has been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee for over 22 years. At the trial of the now-defunct media baron Conrad Black, Marie-José Kravis testified against him, providing evidence for the prosecution. Other prominent Canadians who have attended the Bilderberg conferences include former Prime Minister of Canada Lester B. Pearson, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. Many other influential Canadian politicians and business leaders have also attended the secret meetings, including former NDP leader Bob Rae, former Liberal Party leaders Stéphane Dion and Michael Ignatieff, former Premier of Ontario Mike Harris, former Premier of New Brunswick Bernard Lord, former Premier of British Columbia Gordon Campbell, the Premier of Alberta Alison Redford, the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper Nigel S. Wright, and Power Corporation of Canada CEO Paul Desmarais Sr. In fact, nearly every Canadian Prime Minister back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau has worked for Power Corp.
In 1996, you were at the Bilderberg meeting, and also there was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin.
I don't know if I was at that meeting. I've only been to a few of them, but Bilderberg and Trilateral are not really think tanks. They're simply individuals who get together who are from business, the political world, the media, others, and discuss ideas. And they influence each other through that.
Shortly after Dan and Steve got back from the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, I decided to file some Access to Information Act requests for information on both Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, and for Nigel S. Wright, who is the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I received two notices. One was for Nigel S. Wright, and it actually revealed very little. They just said that they didn't have any record of him having attended the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, even though he was on the official attendees list. In 2011, the Harper government decided to amend the Access to Information Act and privacy request forms, making it so that anybody that was on the Prime Minister's cabinet was exempt from releasing any personal information. In the case of Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, I did receive actually quite a big disclosure from their Executive Council office in Alberta. 31 pages were disclosed to me just the other day. All sorts of different pages have notices to destroy these emails, do not release this information to the public, do not release any information about your travel itinerary prior to attending the meeting. But a lot of the stuff is redacted. A lot of this information is redacted out. That's cited under different sections of the Privacy Protection Act, which is goes hand in hand with the Access to Information Act request. So any other information that was in there about other people has been redacted out. There's also a page in here that describes the nature of the meetings off the record. Fruitful discussions are enhanced by an atmosphere of mutual trust in which participants can express themselves freely. All discussions are therefore private and off the record. The press is excluded from the meetings. A list of participants will be released to the press on the eve of the conference. There's nothing to hide. If you're doing good things, you don't have anything to hide. There's only something to hide if you don't want people hearing what you're saying. That's the only reason to say it off the record, is that you wouldn't want to be quoted on something that could be damaging to your career.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
How do you feel about secrecy in government?
It's a scary thing. I mean, it's secret, so I don't really know much about it.
I can understand if the secrecy is for national security, but, you know, secrecy and covering up, you know, financial documents and things like that, I think as taxpayers, you know, we have the right to know what's going on in our government.
I think secrecy is pretty inherent in the Canadian government, for sure, and in all government. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish government was completely democratic, which would mean that we would be a part of it. But seeing as, like, we have representatives in this house deciding on issues for us, secrecy kind of just comes with that.
I honestly don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be secret. I don't think anything should be secret. I think if anything needs to be said, it needs to be said in front of the people here that can hear it.
We elect people to govern us in a democratic way. And when those people fall, you know, prey to, you know, individuals that have money or, you know, have leverage on them, it's no different than a dictatorship.
When you have, like, government officials and then you have financiers and, like, heads of, like, banks meeting behind closed doors, that's already against the law.
We have really no idea. And without you guys, we wouldn't be around to know, so.
The more independent media that covers events like this or like anything gives a more unbiased opinion, considering how slanted our current media is.
It doesn't have to be a, you know, massive media tycoon that's controlling what's being said anymore, you know. The average person can do it, right? Which is, I mean, you know, that's an amazing feat. We didn't have that 50 years ago. We didn't have that at all.
It's time to get it out there. We should at least know.
Almost everybody here has a camera. They're all doing live streaming. They're all, you know, interviewing people. I mean, there is just everywhere from, you know, really big names with big websites to just people doing their own little thing. And it's crazy. I mean, Everybody has a camera this year.
We live in the time of intelligence, of technology, of instant information. And more these people are realizing that, and they're going to realize that today with the hundreds of people that are surrounding the Marriott Hotel where Bilderberg 2012 is being held.
What do you think about, you know, the independent media's these days ability to use social media and live streaming at these kinds of events?
It's amazing, and it shows you how many people that are getting aware and politically aware to this.
And everyone's becoming the independent media because of the double-edged sword that is social media. It's also, of course, a spy tool, as everyone knows.
They're worried about us. They're worried about you. They're worried about every person out here with a cell phone that's able to broadcast live or put the video online, where in the decades past it would require an entire news crew, an assignment, tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now we can do it standing out here with a cell phone. So their technology that they're using to bug us, their Orwellian nightmare, Big Brothers, or surveillance systems, we're just turning it against them and showing them that we're watching.
What we're seeing here in 2012 represents not just an evolution of social media, of independent media, of the ability of citizen journalists to bring attention to causes that and events that the mainstream media will refuse to cover.
You had thousands and thousands of people watching live stream video. You know, they're interested. People are dying for real information, truth.
We are able to pretty much broadcast to the world, to thousands of people, live, unedited, uncut, as everything's happening, pretty much just through a cell phone. We're living in amazing times. The technology is advancing.
It's like more than it's a protest, it's almost an independent media summit. You know, there are at least 20 cameras here live streaming, not all like with some central hub. No, 20 independent media outlets, 20 individuals doing separate live streams.
We are making a difference. We are forcing the mainstream media to cover these events, you know, and they are coming kicking and screaming, but they are coming.
If you had an opportunity to maybe say a short little message to the people in that room, the people sitting around that table, what might you say to them?
That's a hard question.
It's a tough one, I know. It's a tough one. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It is.
Second. But if I could say anything to the Bilderbergers is, when you do things in darkness, they will come to the light, and they are. We're here just to shine that light. I don't hate you. I'm not going to spend my energy just to negatively go after you, but I will expose you, and I will talk to you, and I will communicate with you with words to try to make you and the world understand that there's a lot more going on than we actually know, and we deserve to know what's happening. We're human beings. We're just as equal as you. And we're all in this world together.
My message to the globalist is, the sleeping giant that is humanity is awakening. It's 1776 against their 1984 worldwide. Their system of 1984 against the spirit of liberty. And they will be defeated. And they know it, and they're starting to run scared, and they should be, because information is power. And the truth is setting us free.
We know who you are, and we're taking our fate back.
We know who you are, and we're going to expose you all the way. So we're not stopping. We're going to be growing in numbers 100 times this in the future. So just wait. Just wait. We're coming.
I'm sure you guys realize, you know, that this is the fate of the planet. You guys are in control one way or another. People are finding out what's going on.
Life is short. We should live it to the fullest and treat people with respect, honesty, dignity, and compassion. And you could change your life in any moment, any time, and just think about the decisions you're making and how they affect people and how they hurt people, and understand there's real consequences for those decisions that you guys have made, that you guys will have to live with for an eternity, pretty much.
When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you the world. Well, guess what? You've got the world, and we're not going to bow down and worship you. Those filthy deeds that you have done in secret are now being shouted from the housetops. We are on to you.
The reach of the Bilderberg Group extends to every level of the policy apparatus in both the private and public sectors. Its members over the years have been the most influential and powerful individuals in the world. Whether or not they act in concert with each other or simply influence one another through these meetings is beside the point. The decisions made by each of these individuals have a ripple effect for the rest of the world. For every action, there is an equal but opposite reaction. The creation of this new Orwellian technotronic society has spawned a new generation of warrior, information warriors, whose weapons are the very technologies created to enslave them. As the old forms of media slowly die away, this generation is finding new and exciting ways to spread information, open dialogue, and become the true citizen media. The Bilderberg Group and the individuals that attend are now facing a revolutionary adversary, an informed citizenry armed with the right questions and looking for the true answers.
Well, in shining a much-needed light upon these unprecedented levels of secrecy and powerful world players, this new age of citizen media bravely contends that the Bilderberg Group's lobbying powers represent nothing less than a threat to the democratic process. Well, that's it, everyone, for this week. Bye-bye for now.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, Subhanahu wa Taala. And especially the last of them, Muhammad al-Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about psychological diseases and the causes of those psychological diseases within us and in our society. And we said that faith in God, the conviction and the belief in God will help mankind to prevail against these psychological diseases and the carnal soul which guides you all the time towards materialism and false lust and desires. Similarly, faith in resurrection and afterlife removes the intolerable strain induced by the idea of absolute annihilation and extinction. Because as you guys know, as you dear brothers and sisters know, we have people out there who believe that after death there will be annihilation, but when they reach the last moments of their lives and their soul and spirit reaches their throat, you see that they struggle and their eyes, their seeing, their visions become piercing, sharp. All the veils, the hujub, all those veils that prevailed in these societies of ours will be gone and they will see the truth. And some of our mystic scholars saw the truth here on this earth prior to their own death. Death is a bridge, it is a threshold which links us to the next realm, to be able to go towards that realm to reach that station, we have to pass death. The person with such a faith is convinced that at the threshold of death, the door to another world will open in front of him, and he will enter an eternal life in its everlasting bounties that cannot be compared with the joys of this world. This faith results in eliminating another agent of mental anxiety, which is the anguish of absolute non-existence. We do not believe in such a concept by the name of non-existence, or in Arabic called Adam. We do not believe in anything called Adam, non-existence. Everything that is, dear brothers and sisters, is wujud, existence. And Allah, He is the supreme existence. And our existence goes back to that real existence, which is the main source, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Ya ayyuha an-nas antumul fuqara ila Allah wallahu huwal ghaniyul hamid. O mankind, says the noble Quran, says Allah, O mankind, you are the ones in need, in sheer need, and Allah, He is the one free from needs, the praiseworthy.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Thus, there is nothing called Adam or non-existence. Everything that is existence, and we are the manifestations of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Like the sun and its rays, like the ocean and its waves. The waves gets their existence from the ocean. It is nothing except the water of the ocean. And the same goes for the rays of the sun. The rays gets and receives its existence from the sun. And it is nothing without the sun. Faith not only removes anxiety and stress from the human heart, it can also protect it from being overwhelmed by calamities and agitation and agony. The noble Quran describes the role of faith in these words. If you have faith, do not yield to fear and sorrow, for you have an upper hand over the others on account of this asset of faith. Chapter 3, verse 139. This verse drives home the point that we have tried to make in these programs, that faith is a firm shield for the soul in its encounter with the agents of anxiety, stress, producing a certain immunity in the human being, a shield which helps you, defends you from those psychological diseases of our society, and especially a society which is dominated by the ideology of postmodernism, with its materialism and individualism and skepticism and relativism and all the other isms. It would be like a shield for you, dear brothers and sisters, producing a certain immunity and protection in the human being. If one should lack a complete faith, and should the agents of anxiety penetrate to the core of our soul, it is again faith by relying on which he or she can free his mind from the burden of agony and purge the effects of suffering from the tablet of the heart. Thus, if we even have lower levels of faith or iman, even those lower levels can help us and rescue us and free us from these burdens of the mind, these anxieties that affects us and gives us suffering. The glorious Quran says, in God's remembrance and reliance upon Him are at rest the hearts of those who have faith and do righteous deeds. Chapter 13, verse 28. And I will end with this verse, dear brothers and sisters. Till next time, may Allah's remembrance and reliance upon Him give us all faith and rest and tranquility. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Is all I need.
All I need.
Is all I need.
Is all I need.
All I need.
Is all I need.
Oh, 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 oh. Your love is all I need.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle.